Alright, so let's go ahead and get started. Man, you guys are totally impressing me. I lay a bet with Doug Klein that only about 30 of you would show today. Look at this. That's amazing. Between the snow and the holidays, whatever. So, alright. So, as most of you probably don't need a reminder, we have exam 3, December 5. So, a week from Thursday. It's going to be during lecture time here. If you're in organic chemistry, I'm aware that you have an exam that day. I feel your pain. Oh, well. I've been there, so I'm not happy about it. I do literally sympathize, but no, I'm not about to leave my test or let you take it another day. So you know in advance, so study hard and get a good night's sleep beforehand and have a snack with you, whatever. So. Anyway, this time we're gonna go wild. You can use both sides of an 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper to write anything you want on it. Now, I meant to caution you about this for the last test, but let me sort of say it again. If you are actually happy about this, if you care. If you're thinking, oh good, now I can write even more of the book on this test, on this paper, you need to rethink what you're doing. Okay? Because if your focus is on trying to get everything condensed on the sheet, you're actually spending your time in a very unwise way. So I'd rather you spend time learning how to think about things and questioning what it is you know, being systematic, getting stuff straightened out from problems. And just write a few things on the sheet that are things that are always bothering you, or that if you just simply had on the sheet, you would feel better. If the thought is, I'm going to go use the copy machine in this particular library because I can take the book and downsize it to this big and put all the sheets on it. Copy all the sheets on it. I've seen it happen. I've seen people put like 4 chapters of the textbook on the sheet. That's a complete waste of time, and you are completely deceiving yourself if you think that that's going to help you get a good grade in your class. So let me just be very blunt about that. However, if there's a kind of problem that you're always having trouble with, or this whole procession thing, this is something that really bothers you, by all means, put one of those problems on your sheet, that kind of thing. Generally, I will put the formulas that I think you need on the sheet. So, certainly you can put formulas that you're always using and think you need, but you'll have that formula sheet in advance, or I'll try to get it to you in advance. If I don't, it'll be basically what was on exam 3 last year, so you can look at it, and you can see all the stuff that will be on there. And it will be starting from what you have for your last step. So, okay? There won't be a whole lot more to add. It's just the sort of the vector stuff for rotation. I am trying to arrange for a room. It will have to be December 3rd at about 4:30 because that's the only window I have. So I'll try to get a room for this question and answer session, and you're welcome to come and ask anything you want at that point. You're welcome to email if you wish. I'll be playing for a lot of Wednesdays, so I won't be able to reply necessarily in a timely way that day. Any questions, concerns about your exam? Okay. I also want to point out, and remember, this one's going to be during lecture time. It will be in here, which means it will be tight, and I'm sorry for that. I tend to try to bring these things into other rooms, but I won't be able to do that if we have the exam during lecture time. Okay, so fluids are fun. I hope you think so. You probably don't want to share that with your mom over the holidays. We've been doing statics, okay, and with statics, one of the things that we use, density turns out to be sort of what you use with fluids. It's not generally that you use mass, because it turns out that rather than masses and forces, you use densities and pressures for the most part. So we define something called the specific gravity. Certainly, often you may have to use just flat-out density, but sometimes things will be defined in terms of specific gravities because that, in a sense, is very relevant in the real world where often what you're wanting to know is whether something's going to float or sink in a pond of water. So specific gravity is the density of the material relative to water at 4 degrees. The water at 4 degrees is because that is the densest form of water, denser than ice, which of course is why ice floats. But if this number is greater than 1, then generally it will sink, and if it's less than 1, it will float. We work with pressure a lot, that's force per unit area, so it's in newtons per meter squared, which we also call Pascal, or the MKS system would be these two, but you'll often see pressure measured in torr or atmospheres and probably some other measurements. So we have one law, which is Pascal's law, which was brought to us by this guy, who looks like he was in a French rock band back when. But what he found was that it isn't the weight of a fluid that's really important. It's the pressure or the height of the fluid. So in Pascal's law, we looked at it in this form. Maybe one good way to think about it is really the pressure difference, or the so-called pressure head that people will talk about. If you want to know the pressure at a certain point in the liquid, what's relevant really is the height of the liquid up above it. And yes, there may be pressure on the gas on top, but often what is really of interest to you is the pressure difference between two points. So for you, if you're going to go diving, you're used to dealing with things at one atmosphere, the pressure of the gas on top of the water. So that's sort of your baseline. What you feel, what hurts you biologically, what changes things if you dive deep, is the difference in the pressure, the fact that this rho GH acts on as you go deeper. Anyway, here's a picture or a sketch of this guy actually running an interesting experiment where he put a barrel together, and you can't see it because it's not a good reproduction for the projector. But you see that he has a big tube here, and he kept filling it. This is like an early version of the beer bong, if you're into that kind of thing. So he's filling and filling and filling, and actually he filled it up and was able to burst the barrel itself. Whereas the volume of the water that he's adding in here really isn't so great. But as he goes higher and higher, the pressure here increases. So this is one of the ways he's able to demonstrate this equation is very important. And so one of the things this demonstrates is that the pressure that's applied to this enclosed fluid is really transmitted undiminished at every point. So it blows out the sides of the barrel. And so remember that it's the height, not the weight, and it can be sort of deceptive, so you want to keep that in mind. So the other thing we talked about already in hydrostatics is called Archimedes principle. And it's been around for a long time, actually. And I think, in fact, there are some stories about Archimedes using this to prove to someone that a crown was made of gold and not some mixture of gold and something else. But for Archimedes problems, your intuition can often mislead you a little bit, or they can seem to be that you're missing some stuff. So you really, 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 really usually actually need to go back to this definition and start from that when you think about these problems. And what it says is that there is a force on an object that is submerged or partially submerged in a fluid, and that force is equal to the weight of the displaced fluid. Okay? A way to think about it is, if I'm going to take, say, a ball and push it underwater, I literally have to push out of the way all the fluid that is there that takes up the volume of that ball. It has to push back with a reaction force, and you can sort of think of that reaction force as being the buoyant force. So that's a way to think about it. But you really want to come all the way down to this definition much of the time. So let me actually do a demo on that one while we're here. All right. So what I have here is a mass that is hanging on a spring balance. So this balance is calibrated to pull the spring, and depending on the force with which I pull the spring, this tells you how many newtons it is. I assume it's newtons. Doesn't really matter, some unit of force. If I pull down on this thing, you measure a bigger value. If I lift it up, you measure a smaller value. Right now, this thing tells you what is the force with which this thing is, with which this mass and this container and stuff are pulling down, okay? And it doesn't really matter, but the value is this, okay? And I'm not going to change that. So what I have here is a bucket with water in it and just a spout here. So it's just an empty bucket. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to lower or raise the bottom, actually. I'm going to set it up so that this thing is just submerged into the water. And as it begins to go into the water, what do you think is going to happen to the weight here? As I displace water, there will be an upward force which is equal to the weight of the displaced water. Okay? Let me make sure it pops. That's right. Okay, this is empty. And now I'm starting to pull this thing up, the water level up over this thing. And we're going to never mind, I did that wrong. I gotta do something first. To do this right, what I'd like to do is to put the water level up just to the point where it's starting to drain out, so that as I put this volume into the water, all the water that drains out is caught here. Okay? Alright, so you can see that I now have water. This thing is completely free. I have water dripping out. Now, I'm going to empty this container, because what I'd like to do is to capture the water that is equal to the volume of this thing. That is the water that is displaced. Okay? So now I'm going to raise this, and as it raises, as it rises in across the weight here, it's going to displace water, and that water is going to get collected. And I will continue to raise this until I see that the fluid has just covered the mass. Basically about right there. And make sure that it's free. Okay. Because we have the buoyant force of the fluid on the mass, the spring is pulled with less force. And so you can see that it now weighs less according to this. This is the volume of the water that was displaced. what will happen if I now take that water and I pour it in here? The buoyant force, that is the difference between this and that, that is the force with which it's pushing up, is equal to the weight of the displaced water. That's the displaced water. I now have an empty container here, and I'm going to pour that water in this container. And when I do, I'm basically adding in that weight. And this thing's going to go back to where it was. Okay? Okay, well, that's what's supposed to happen. So that dude knew what he was talking about. It seems to work. So that's Archimedes' principle. Alright, so that's basically a proof of this. And you always want to go back to that when you do the problem. Alright, so let's do a problem. I've always heard, oh, that's just the tip of the iceberg. And that is a saying that comes about because what you see at the iceberg above the water isn't very big compared to what is beneath the water. And what I'd like to do now is, given some of the parameters in this case, which is seawater has a specific gravity of about 1.03, and ice has a specific gravity of about 0.92, what I'd like to do is to calculate what is the fraction of the iceberg that is submerged. So, I haven't given you a whole lot of information here, so you really just have to think your way through what's going on and not be scared by the fact that it's not really set up that cleanly for you. What you have is a mass. That mass has a force of gravity down on it, and it has a buoyant force that is up. The buoyant force is equal to the weight of the displaced fluid. That's really all I know about it, so we have to use that. We're going to say that, we know we've already defined what FB is, really. And I want to now I haven't given you volumes or anything like that, so we're just going to say that V is equal to the volume of the iceberg. And we're going to say that X is equal to the fraction of the iceberg that's submerged. Okay. So now we sort of have things set up. So what we know, since this thing is at equilibrium, it's floating there, we know that Mg must equal the buoyant force. All right, so that means that the volume of the iceberg times the density of the ice, that will be equal to the mass of the iceberg times G, must equal the buoyant force, which is the weight of the displaced fluid. So that's going to be, remember, the density of the displaced fluid is driven by the density of seawater. So we're going to, this row is that for ice on the left-hand side. So
we want on the right-hand side, we want to write down the mass of the displaced fluid. So that's going to be the density of the displaced fluid, rho of seawater, times the volume of the displaced fluid, which will be equal to the volume of the iceberg times the fraction of the iceberg which is underwater. Okay? And that will be, this thing then is the mass that's is displaced, and then we multiply that by G in order to have the weight of the displaced fluid. And we weren't given the actual density of the ice or the actual density of the seawater. What we were given is a specific gravity. So if we divide through both sides, by rho of water at 4 degrees centigrade, then we get that V, and the G's cancel out, so we get V times the specific gravity of ice is equal to V times the specific gravity of seawater times X. Actually, the V's cancel too. So what we find is that the specific gravity of ice over that for water, seawater, is equal to X, and those numbers we have, that was equal to 1.03 over 0.92, or 0.92, 0.92 over 1.03, which when I calculated it was 89%. Okay? So if the specific gravities are right, and I think they're right, 89% of icebergs are actually under the water. That's pretty cool. But this gives you a sense, this one of the reasons I like this problem is it's easy to look at it and go, wow, I'm not given all the stuff I need. I don't know anything about the volume. I don't know anything about the densities. What do I do? And my advice is you just jump into it using what you know about the buoyant force, which is it is equal to the weight of the displaced fluid. And you start with that, and you set up the equilibrium, and then you let that flow and see if you can work it out, even if you're missing some of the stuff along the way. In this case, for example, the volume of this iceberg canceled out. You didn't need it. Okay? You weren't given the core densities, you were given specific gravities, which you basically could use within the problem as is. Okay? So always go back to that definition and just use it. Any questions about buoyancy type stuff? Okay. So what I'd like to do now is let things move in the fluid problem. So I want to do what a physicist would call fluid dynamics. Again, because often it boils down to dealing with things with water. Sometimes this is called hydrodynamics. But it could literally be used for things other than water, even liquids. So we're going to assume that we have what is called an ideal fluid. I think I mentioned this to you earlier. So that means we have no viscosity. So that's really quite an approximation in many ways. I mean, if you're dealing with water, I mean, often whether you would think of water as having a viscosity or not, it really depends on what it is that you're doing. Right? I think if I were modeling the flow of blood around the body, I'd probably think of it as having a viscosity. It's probably very important. If I were modeling how the fluid flows in a system of pipes around Bausch and Lomb, probably no viscosity is a very good approximation. So how good this is really depends a bit on the systems you're dealing with and the fluid itself. Some fluids very obviously have a lot of viscosity, like molasses and syrups and things like that. Most fluids less so. Carbon tetrachloride doesn't seem to have, even less than water, it seems, if you played with that in the lab. We're also going to assume that it is incompressible. For now, okay? So with those ideas in mind, let's look at a system. Let me assume that I have a pipe that changes in cross-section and let us assume that we have a fluid that is moving with a velocity V1 as it goes in the thin end of the pipe. So I'm going to sort of imagine an element of fluid here, if you will. We're going to say that there's a cross-sectional area, A1. Over on this side, the pipe has gotten bigger. So we're going to say we have a cross-sectional area A2 on that side. And let's just say that this is sort of some section of pipe in the middle of some big system, and fluid is flowing through it, which means since it is incompressible, the fluid is coming in here, it's going out there. So what that means is that, maybe I'll give it a better color. Oh, great, sorry. We'll leave the color as it is. All right, so what that means is that you might have so what I'm trying to draw, a little bit hard to see, is that I'm pushing an element of fluid of this size in the pipe here on this end. And because the fluid is incompressible, it means that since this is all filled with fluid, I have to have that volume of fluid come out the other end at the same time. So think about it that way. So what I've tried to draw here is a volume of fluid that's equivalent to the volume that I have here. This cross-sectional area is bigger, so this distance is going to be less. So if the fluid is flowing, let's say that it flows this distance in a time, delta t, then this distance is going to be the velocity of the fluid, V1, times delta T. And the amount of fluid that then has to flow out within that same amount of time on this end is going to be equal to the velocity here on the other end. Times the same T. You okay with that? So, if we say that the fluid is incompressible, again, basic common sense says whatever volume I shove in on this side has to be the same as the volume that comes out on that side. So that means that I can set this volume equal to that volume. So that would be area 1, so that's this area, times that distance, which is V1 times delta T. That must equal this area times this distance, that would give me the volume of this disk of water, times, which is, the distance is V2 delta T, so this is equal to A2. V2 delta T. The delta T's cancel, and we get that A1 times V1 is equal to A2 times V2. And this is called the equation of continuity. So the area times the velocity for flow through this system is basically constant. So you probably already know this, right? You just never thought about it this way. But you have a hose, you're sitting here, your obnoxious little brother is 20 feet away, and you want to blast him with the hose. What do? You put your thumb over the end of the hose, reducing the cross-sectional area. The water is still flowing, but it now has to flow out much faster because of continuity. And so now it comes flying out fast and you can blast your obnoxious little brother. See, it's great. If you're into whitewater rafting, where does the water get fast? When you go through gorges that sort of constrain the river. When the river has room to flow and its cross-sectional area is big, it's nice and slow. But when you put it into a gorge, and effectively the cross-sectional area through which it can flow is much smaller, the speed of the water is much greater. Right? So this is how we do it in mathematics. This is the physics way of taking beautiful things like blasting your little brother or pretty gorges and ruining them with some stupid equation. It works. Okay, any questions on this? This is also works for blood, if you're into that kind of thing. Sorry, I sort of meant that in a constructive way rather than a destructive way. So you might imagine that the velocity of blood through capillaries would be great, although you have lots of capillaries, so it's not completely obvious in a sense. It's not a single pipe. But if you're wanting to understand blood flow at one level, you know, you're just filled with pipes, and you can actually use this kind of information. I think I assign a problem for you that actually takes an estimate of the number of capillaries, and you can estimate the blood flow through them, or something about the pressure. I don't remember right now, but we'll all figure that out next week or the week after. Okay, so that's the equation of continuity. It's really not a complicated equation, it's just sort of duh. If I shove stuff in on this end, it comes out on that end because the stuff can't be compressed. So, practically speaking, it really does help you relate the velocity of the fluid from point to point in some system. Now, why would you care? Well, fluids are a little harder to visualize in some ways than balls, but energy is very much the same. The energy conservation is very important, even if you're dealing with fluids. So what I'd like to do is to imagine that we now, you'll note that the way that I drew this, maybe not perfect, but I basically intended for this all to be at one height, so that you sort of didn't have gravitational potential energy coming into play. We've already eliminated friction from the problem, but when I say that the fluid is shoved in this end, you might imagine that there's some pressure that's going to have some force or some work that's going there. So what I want to do is to think about energy conservation as applied to fluids. So let's imagine that we have a pipe, like so, and this time, let me allow the pipe to do this. And I sort of want to do the same thing in that I want to have some element of fluid here. I want to imagine it moving from one point to the other in the system. And we're going to say that there's a height difference. I'm going to let there be a pressure 1 at this end of the tube and a pressure 2 at that end of the tube. So let's use energy conservation for a moment. For some fluid element, or what I really mean by that is some small volume of the fluid, okay? And we're going to say that it's a big volume V. So if you want to think about it, you know, this is the thing, it has some volume V, and I better be careful, I don't want that to look like a velocity. We're going to let this move up to here, and it has a volume V. Those are not velocities. Okay? And let's just think our way through the energy conservation for a moment. If we ask, what does it take to move, say, a ball from here over to there, then we might imagine it would take, there would be some amount of work done on the ball to move it. There might be a change in its kinetic energy, and there might be a change in its potential energy. And what energy conservation tells us is that if we're in a conservative system, no friction, okay, if I do so much work on the system, that energy goes into the change in the potential energy plus the change in the kinetic energy. So that means that this quantity is basically a constant. So if I do, or the work done on the system plus its kinetic energy plus its gravitational potential energy is going to be a constant. You okay with that? Okay, so that we've seen in mechanics so far. So let me take that expression and let me divide everything through by the volume. Work is equal to force times distance, basically. I'm going to divide that by the volume. 1/2 mv squared, I'm going to divide by the volume, plus mgh divide by the volume. Volume is equal to the cross-sectional area times the the distance, basically. So if I ask, how much work does it take for me to push at a distance V? Force per unit area, volume here is area times D. The force per unit area is the pressure, and the D's cancel. So the first term, and that's not an equals, that should be a plus. So if I convert this volume to the area times distance, the distances cancel, and I have force per unit area, which is a pressure. So the pressure term counts as sort of how much work I'm doing on one end of this fluid. Plus 1/2 mass per unit volume is density, so that's rho V squared, plus mass per unit volume is density, rho GH is equal to a constant. And this is what we know as Bernoulli's equation. For any point in the fluid, if it's incompressible, ideal fluid, the pressure in the fluid plus 1/2 rho V squared, which is a measure of its kinetic energy, plus rho GH, a measure of its gravitational and potential energy, is a constant. Okay. I can see from some of the faces that you find this very exciting. This actually is extremely cool. How many of you, do we have a baseball player in here, a baseball pitcher, or somebody who plays on the baseball team? Not a one? Okay, do we have anyone who's actually ever played baseball? Do you have anyone who's ever watched a baseball game? All right, so we got a few. Does anybody have any idea what a curveball is? Yeah, what's a curveball? All right, so let me get this. All right, so what you're telling me is a curveball. So I take a baseball and I throw it and I do this. All right. And what happens, and we'll talk about directions in a moment, but if you're a baseball batter, what's happening is that ball is coming at you, and you project it sort of straight, and what happens is the ball will do some weird curve, okay? Which means you swing, and where you thought the ball was going to be, it ain't, because it's somewhere else. So that's the whole point of it. All right? And so let's see if we can sort of understand this a little bit. Have you ever noticed, if you've ever looked at a baseball, it has these weird threads on it that sort of take this shape going around the sphere. All right? And those threads actually stick out a little bit from the surface of the ball. Okay? And what will happen is if you are throwing a ball and you spin it fast, what's going to happen is as the baseball flies through the air, let us say for the moment that we spin this baseball so that it is spinning like that, and it is moving this direction. So certainly in tennis we call that a top spin, okay? And I think you called it a top spin a moment ago. So we're spinning it so that it's spinning like this as it goes through the air. That way. Let us imagine what's happening with the airflow. We have the air. Oh, I want the air to be a different color. We have the airflow across the ball like this. Sort of like that, okay? And now, let's think a bit about what's happening. This ball is spinning fast this way. It has basically little bits of it that are sticking up a little bit off the surface. So as it is spinning this way, those little bits of fiber are pushing against the air that's trying to flow across the baseball. So what happens is it slows down the velocity of the air here a little bit. At the same time, it's spinning this way, and it will speed up the flow of the air that way. Okay? So what that means is that if we consider the velocity of the air on the top, and we consider the velocity of the air passing the surface on the bottom, that little argument is saying that here we slow it down a little bit because we have something moving against it. Here it's speeding up a little bit, which means that the air on the bottom is going faster than the air on the top. VB is greater than VT.
If Bernoulli's equation is constant on both, is true for both of these surfaces, because this is incompressible fluid, this distance is a very small distance, so H is going to be effectively zero. There's not going to be any difference between the gravitational potential energy term at the top of baseball and the bottom of baseball. So that's not different, which means the pressure plus 1/2 rho V squared is equal here and here. But V is bigger here than it is here. If these terms are equal and VB is bigger down here, it means that P, or the pressure, has to be bigger here.
P at the top plus 1/2 rho V at the top squared is equal to P at the bottom plus 1/2 rho V at the bottom squared.
If we believe that the top velocity is smaller than the bottom velocity, that is, this number is smaller than that number, then this number must be bigger than that number.
You okay with that? So if I have this thing and I have more pressure here than I have here, it's got to move down because there's a net force, because the area is the same on both sides. Okay? So what that says is that if I take this ball and I throw it and I spin it like that, usually I think they spin it not exactly like this, but a little bit like that. What it's saying is, from the baseball pitcher's point of view, as this thing goes flying through the air, it's going to do a little bit of that, a little bit like that. If you're a baseball batter, okay, the ball is coming at you. All right, if you're a right-handed batter, right, you're over here. What it says is the ball is going to be coming at you, and it's going to sort of go down and away from you. Does anybody play baseball at a real level and can tell me that's what a curveball actually does? That's what it does, right? And if the baseball pitcher decides to do it that way, okay, so they now spin it more like this, then, from my point of view, the same sort of thing happens, except now it's going to go like that. So as a baseball batter, as it's coming into me, it's going to be coming at me and sort of go down and toward me, so toward my legs or something. Right? It's cool. Okay, so
what's the deal with a knuckleball? You've never watched baseball before in your life, I'm sorry. We'll do other examples. What about knuckleballs? So historically, if you're a pitcher and you can throw a knuckleball, you're phenomenal, you're a phenom. There's some that are really good at it. It's really hard to do it and get enough speed on it. But with a knuckleball, basically what you do is you hold it in such a way that when you throw it, you try to throw it so it has no spin on it at all. And if it has no spin on it at all, what it means is that as the air is blowing past the thing, the threads are sort of confronting the airflow in some random sort of way. And so there's going to be sort of little bit of pressure or a little bit like minor little sails. It will sort of cause the ball to shift in sort of random ways in the air. So as a batter, that ball's coming at you and it sort of dances around a little bit. You have no idea where that ball's going to go. Neither does the catcher. So catchers hate knuckleball pitchers because they're not quite sure where the ball is going to go either. But it's because they're able to throw it without the spin. The other thing about the spin is it creates a lot of stability to the ball, right? Because of the angular momentum. But then you have the pressure which will cause the movement. So Bernoulli's equation, baseball is all about it. How many of you played tennis? So when you play tennis and you learn to serve, if you watch, and it's a little hard to explain if you've not really been a tennis player, but as you're learning to serve hard, okay, what you traditionally learn to do is you come back with the tennis racket and then you go forward and you go straight through the ball. And when you do, when you hit the ball, you're basically hitting it flat. And it goes, now here's the net, and it basically goes flat. And it turns out that as you get harder and harder with your tennis serve, it's really hard to keep that into the small court that it has to go in to play the game. Because in tennis, you have to hit the ball and it's got to go into the small square on the other side of the net. So as you get harder and harder with how you hit the ball, the window for being able to hit that little court is harder and harder. So the trick that you use in order to do this is instead of going straight through the ball and serve, if you watch tennis players, they'll do this over the top of the ball. And sometimes it's ridiculous. So it's like that. And when they do, they hit the ball and it's got massive top spin. And so now it's coming, and as it crosses the net, it just basically like this, straight into that court. And then when it hits, because it's got all the spin, you get this big kick, a big jump. So it's a very different ball to hit. And you know they do something completely different. If they're in the middle of the game, they sometimes will slice under a ball, and you'll sort of see that ball will be going, and it'll actually float up a little bit again because it's now spinning this way. So you'll actually have more pressure up here, and so it will rise a little bit and stall out and then drop, and now because it's got the backspin, it basically will kick back a little bit and it's much harder to catch up to. So again, it's all spin in that game. In golf, you hit a slice, what's happening? You slice across the ball like that, it's spinning sideways, and that ball, right? So it's all Bernoulli. Some of you, hopefully, going to catch airplanes tonight or tomorrow. I want you to pay attention to the wings. If you look at an airplane wing, it looks a little bit like this, all right? And if you imagine the airflow across it,
There's a shape to the wing, actually. It's called an airfoil. And the whole point of it is you basically set it up so that if you were to think of an element of the fluid that you're passing through, and this is one of those cases where if you're going fast through air, you can think of it as incompressible. Because if it were super compressible, you'd build up a whole lot of air here and the plane wouldn't go anywhere. So you think of this as incompressible, so the air flows across this volume. This distance is designed to be longer than this distance. But the fluid that's separated here basically has to come back together over here, or you will have built up some compression of fluid. So that doesn't happen. So what that means is the way this thing is set up is this flies through the air. You can think of this air as going faster than this air. If this air is going faster, the 1/2 rho v squared term is bigger, the pressure term is smaller here than it is here. So you will have a net force of lift, which is equal to that difference in pressure times the area of the wing. Now, you might be sitting there going, the sky's smoking movies, because everybody's seen pictures of planes flying upside down. Put that one in your pipe and smoke it. So that's not all that's operating, right? You can take this wing, and your angle of attack is very important. So if you take the wing and you sort of have it angled this way, then the air, some of the air is sort of kicked down, and now by momentum conservation, you know you're going to have a force in the upward direction. So it's a game between these two things. So the planes want to get going very fast. Why do they want to get going very fast? Because when they get going very fast, this pressure difference becomes large enough that you have the lift force is enough to actually put you up in the air. When they're going really fast and they're in the air, you really don't want this to be overly exacerbated, overly done, because you'll have friction. So one of the things you'll notice when you're flying home is that upon takeoff and landing, they take some of the wing toward the back and they sort of extend it down like this. These are all those nasty noises that take you out of your nice reverie in your book or whatever, and you think, oh my God, we're about to crash, because you know, all of a sudden the plane jerks a little bit, it slows down, and you're and if you're looking, if you're by the wing and you're looking, you see it's sort of ridiculous. These flaps come up a little bit and these things come out and they extend way down like this. And the whole point of that is to create a huge airfoil. In part, and also to push, you know, the air is coming through, it'll also help push up a little bit. But the main thing is you want this huge airfoil so that they can slow down. You don't want to be on an airplane where the hydraulics goes out. Because of the hydraulics, they use hydraulics power to move all these flaps and everything. Remember, that's fluid movement. So it can become a very big deal if they lose their fluid. There was a flight before your time, probably, a United flight that was flying from Chicago to Denver. And it was a DC-10, and these are planes that have they have an engine in the tail and two on the wing, you know, one on each wing. And there was a problem in the engine on the tail in that the turbofan broke apart. When the broke apart pieces went everywhere, and when they went everywhere, they actually cut one of the hydraulic lines, which means the plane lost all its hydraulic fluid, which meant they couldn't move their flaps, which to first order meant they couldn't turn, they couldn't do anything much. So the pilots they figured out how to turn the plane by throttling different engines, you know, so they throttle this one up and this one down, and the plane would sort of turn this way. And then, you know, they could slow it down so they could come down, but they could not control the flaps at all. So that meant they didn't have fine controls, because the other thing you do with the flap is, and again, you notice when you're landing, what you'll notice is as the plane is doing this, coming down toward the ground, and you start becoming very sensitive to these things as you get close to the ground and realize how much the plane is doing this crap. And you're like, you know, it's not cool to hit a wing on the ground. And what happens is they'll have little bits of flaps that'll do this. And when they do that, they adjust the airflow, and then they can control what's going on. So that wasn't there, so that was a big problem. But the other thing was they can't slow down very much. It's when they put in this big airfoil that they're able to slow their wind speed down so that they land at a much slower velocity. So when they took this plane and tried to land it in Sioux City, Iowa, they had to bring it in quite fast because they didn't have the lift otherwise, and they were trying to control everything. And it's a sad end to the story, in fact, because a gust of wind caught them right as they were close to the ground, and this tip caught in the plane, cartwheeled, and half the people killed. It was pretty awful. But it all boiled down to this hydraulics. And in fact, they then implemented a hydraulic system where they split it into multiple pieces so that if you lost some of it, you wouldn't lose all of your control. So it's one of these major things to think about. But there's a lot going on with the airframe, the air surfaces on a plane, keep it in the air and control it. So you might think about that when you're flying along later. Don't think about the crash. It doesn't happen very often. I was on a flight a few months later to Denver, and it turned out I was flying with somebody who missed that flight. I was like, oh, cool. Okay, I don't mind flying with you. Yeah, it's pretty awful. Any questions, comments? Okay, so let's do a demo on this. All right. Don't know whether it's better to leave the lights on or off for this. What I have, actually, I'm going to do this. So what I have is a setup that looks like this. So I have air that is going to blow. I've got it connected to an air system, so it's going to blow fairly hard through here. Okay? And I have it open. This air passage is open to three tubes, which all of which have the same cross-sectional area. I'm wide here. These two are the same. I'm narrow here. And I have liquid, which is currently sitting in these tubes, okay, all at the same height. So it's right here. You can see there's the top on the right, the top in the middle, the top on the left. Okay, can you see it? Not so great. You're welcome to move if you can't see it. Alright, so there's yellow liquid that's at this level, here, here, and here. Alright? So what I'd like you to think about for a moment is when I turn the air on and we look at the level of the liquid in these three tubes, is it going to look like all at the same height, or is it going to look like this, or is it going to look like this? represent the levels from the three tubes. And here the levels are different, where the outside tubes now, the liquid will be higher than the middle tube. Here the middle tube are higher than the two outside tubes. So think about that for just a moment. Talk it over with your friends. You'll see a situation as in two. How many of you believe you'll see a situation as in three? Okay, so we have several hands that said one. We had a reasonable number that said two, and maybe slightly more that said three, but it's a pretty even split. And some of you may think the liquid's just going to be blown all over the place, and you're glad that you're not sitting over there. Okay, so let's see what happens. That's a different demo. We'll do that in a sec. That didn't work. Okay. So it's number three. What's happening? Big cross-sectional area here, small here, big here. Think of the fluid flow straight through. Area times velocity must be a constant. Area here is big, velocity is low. Area here is big, velocity is low. So that means the small area here, velocity is high because the fluid has to go through. Okay? If I have high velocity here, then what the Bernoulli's equation tells us is I have high velocity, the pressure must be low, because the pressure and the velocity terms have to be equal, basically. The P plus 1/2 rho v squared. Rho's not changing. So that means high V, low P, have low pressure here, and higher pressure here. The outside gets pushed down, this goes up. Okay? I have here a common funnel and a ping pong ball. If I turn this upside down, what's going to happen? Ta-da! Care to explain that to me? Okay, so what's going on there? Why does the air not blow the ping pong ball out? I didn't even tell you. That hose is blowing air out. It is not blowing in. Thank you. it will blow the ball. So what's going on? Any thoughts? You've got the air doing this. You have airflow that is going to be very fast here. Which means the pressure here will be small. So the pressure here is greater. There's a big force pushing it into the funnel. And you hear that. That's really this air sort of forcing its way through as it's pulling the ball down. But it's all for doing it. Cool. All right. All right. Have a happy holiday. Enjoy your break.